You're listening to The Truth Podcast from PursueGod.org.
Hey, friends, welcome back to the podcast. Today we are in the third week of our How Stuff Works series. And today we're going to talk about how healthy families work. It's Mother's Day coming up, and we want to celebrate the incredible women who shape our homes with love and strength and faith. But today on Mother's Day, I want to give this extra gift, not just to the moms, but to everybody, dads, kids, all of us. And I want to take a look at how healthy families work. Now, here's the truth. I want to start with this. There are no perfect families. There are no perfect moms. There are no perfect dads. There are no perfect kids. We're not talking about how perfect families work. We're talking about how healthy families work. And have you ever gotten a glimpse of a family that does things a little bit differently than yours? That's not what I want to do today. Eventually, by the end of the episode, I want to give you a glimpse, three traits in particular, of healthy families. I want you to see how a healthy family is supposed to function, because the truth is, none of us has ever seen a perfectly healthy family. Maybe some of you grew up in healthier families than others, but today I want to pull back the curtain and I want to show you, like, if you could be a fly on the wall in the home of a healthy family, I want you to see what that would look like. Now, I remember growing up in my family, five kids, mom and dad were in the home, great parents, you know, good relationships among the siblings. But I remember the first time I really can think of getting a glimpse into the like inner workings of a family that was different than mine was a few doors down the street from me. My best friend growing up, his name was Dan Baird. And we would hang out at his house in the summers a lot of times. We would spend a lot of time at his home. And so we got to see how another family worked that was so different from our own family. Now, I don't mean in terms of like parenting and their parents loving their kids. Not so much that. The thing that comes to mind to me is cheese. Because it was in the Baird household that for the very first time, I was introduced to extra sharp cheddar cheese, in particular, Cracker Barrel. You know, the little square, have you ever seen that? The square packages, extra sharp cheddar cheese. And I remember the first time I tasted that, I was like, what is this? Because in my home, we grew up with like imitation Kraft singles, like not even the good stuff, but you know, like the American cheese, the processed cheese that's wrapped in plastic, that like nasty cheese, to be honest with you, that's what I thought of as cheese. That's all I knew when it came to cheese, but not at the Baird's house. At the Baird's house, we had extra sharp cheddar cheese. And I remember tasting it thinking, this is the best thing I've ever tasted in my life. And not only that, but I remember that at the Baird household, you were allowed to just open up the cabinets and grab whatever you want and, you know, eat a snack anytime, not just the extra sharp cheddar cheese, but any snack you could find in there. There were all kinds of snacks. It was like a wonderland. I'd never seen anything like this before, because at my house growing up, you know, with five kids in the home, and my mom and dad were really good with money and really wanted to make sure that, you know, they could afford to send their kids to college someday. So like, we couldn't just open up the cupboard and grab a snack midday. Like, that was a no-no for sure. And by the way, even if we did, there was, you know, just stuff like, you know, pretzels, which are good. I still love pretzels to this day, or maybe saltine crackers. There wasn't a lot to choose from anyway, but it didn't matter because we weren't allowed to just open that up and eat whatever we wanted to. But again, at the Baird house, this family worked differently. Now, I don't know what comes to mind when you think of that question, when you first realize that other families don't operate the same way that your family does. But the point is, we've all seen this. We're only comfortable, or even in many cases, we're only aware of what we know, what we grew up with, what we've seen. And I'm not talking about cheese anymore. I'm talking about like how your parents parent and how they did marriage and how you interacted as siblings. Like, we all, every single family has a way of doing things. And here's the bigger point. Every single family has dysfunction. There's no perfect family out there. And so when a husband and when a man and a woman come together and they get married, they're going to bring by default into their home only the stuff that they know. And so today, that's what we want to do, is I want to do my best to show you three marks of a healthy family, because we didn't all grow up with this. We didn't all grow up with healthy families. And I want to show you, like, what does a good, solid, healthy family look like? How do their parents interact? What are the kids like? Where does God stand in the whole thing? So we're going to get to that today. But first, before we get to that, I want to, just to make us feel a little bit better about ourselves, especially here on Mother's Day, because I don't want anyone to feel judged. I don't want anyone to feel like we're pointing fingers at people, because we all have something to learn. But I want to start by proving that point by sharing about some of the families in the Bible and some of their dysfunction. Because the truth is, when we look to the Bible to see how healthy families work, the truth is, we actually don't have any examples. Really, we have no example. I couldn't think of an example of a healthy family, like a perfectly healthy family, from the Bible. There is far more dysfunction than function when it comes to families in the Bible. Jealousy, rivalry, deceit, betrayal, brokenness, over and over again, from Adam and Eve to David and Bathsheba, and even Jesus's own disciples, family dysfunction is not just a modern problem, it's an ancient problem, it's a human problem, and I want to prove it to you with four families from the Bible. Think about Adam and Eve's family. Cain, the oldest son, grows jealous of his youngest brother, Abel. Abel, remember, brings an offering to God, and Cain brings an offering to God. Cain's offering was rejected, Abel's wasn't. So in a fit of rage and jealousy, Cain murders Abel. First murder in human history. So think about the dysfunctional traits in Adam and Eve's family. Jealousy, insecurity. I mean, do you have some of this in your own family? Inability to manage anger. Do you have anger issues in your own family? Lack of accountability, because Cain denied knowledge of Abel's whereabouts, so he's not accountable. Like, there's so many dysfunctional traits in the first family. So that's where we'll start. How about read a little bit later in the book of Genesis, and you read about Isaac and Rebekah's family. They had twin brothers named Esau and Jacob, and they couldn't be more different. Esau was rugged. He was an outdoorsman. Jacob was quiet. He liked to stay close to home. He was kind of a mama's boy. Rebekah favored Jacob and helped her favorite son deceive Isaac, the dad, into stealing Esau's blessing. So Esau, as the oldest son, was supposed to have a blessing. Jacob, with the help of his mom, stole the blessing. So we see this deep family conflict. You can read more about that in the book of Genesis. So think about the dysfunctional traits in Isaac and Rebekah's family. Favoritism, right? I mean, who doesn't have that in their family? Parental favoritism. Well, it gets worse though. There was deception. There was manipulation. There was broken trust between siblings. Isaac and Rebekah's family was truly dysfunctional. Or how about later on in the New Testament, as you read about David and Bathsheba's family? I don't know if you know this story, but King David sexually coerced Bathsheba, who was married to Uriah, one of David's warriors. So you could kind of say rape. He basically rapes her, essentially. And to cover it up, David arranges for Uriah to be killed in battle. So the child born out of that sin and deceit dies as a consequence. But later, David marries Bathsheba and they have the son Solomon, and he was going to become king. And then on top of all of it, if you really know David's story, later in his life, one of his other sons, Absalom, leads a coup against David and tries to take the throne, steal the throne from his dad. So think about the dysfunctional traits in David and Bathsheba's family. And again, see if you can recognize any of these traits in your own family. Lust, abuse of power, deception, covering up, like not being accountable for your sins, family trauma and the consequences of sin, and the list goes on and on. One more example from the Bible, because we need to take an example from the New Testament as well. And when I think about New Testament dysfunction, it's maybe not as hardcore as some of these Old Testament examples, but I think of Zebedee's family. Now, maybe you don't recognize the name Zebedee, but Zebedee was the father of two of Jesus' disciples, two of his closest disciples, James and John. If you know anything about these guys from the Gospels, like check out Luke 9 or Mark 10 if you want to read up a little bit on it. These guys were ambitious. That's not necessarily bad, but you'll see that it was actually kind of bad in their situation. They were hot-tempered. At one point, they asked Jesus to call down fire from heaven to destroy a Samaritan village. Another time, they tried to secure the highest positions of honor in Jesus' future kingdom. And by the way, their mom kind of helped as well. So they had a mom who was like a helicopter mom as well. All of this stuff caused jealousy and tension among the other disciples. So James and John clearly had some dysfunction in their family. Let's think about some of the traits that we notice from their story. We've got pride, we've got ambition, we've got impulsiveness, we've got anger, we've got like ignorance of servant leadership, all these things that you'd think that they would have learned being in the inner circle of Jesus. And yet James and John too were dysfunctional. And here's the point to all this. Before we get into the traits of a functional family, every family has dysfunction, so don't feel so bad about yours. And look, all of these families and so many more in the Bible, they were still used by God in spite of their dysfunction. So friends, I want you to hear this. Moms, I want you to hear this. Your dysfunction, your lack of health in your family is not a nail in the coffin. I think if you're aware of it, you can not only address the dysfunction and work to be more healthy as a family, but you can still be used by God even in the midst of all of it. So if you were a fly on a wall of a truly healthy family, even though there's not one in the Bible, but if you're going to observe a truly healthy family, what would that look like? What are the traits of a truly healthy family? This is a great thing for young people listening to this episode, maybe even before you're married, maybe young couples, newlywed couples, maybe this is going to be good for you. Or for those of you who even empty nesters like my own family, I think you can still learn from these three traits, even if you blew it and your kids are already out of the house. So let's look at them. Number one, trait number one is families who are Jesus-centered. This is actually principle number one in our survival guide for parenting series. You can find that online. But this is more than about parents. This is for the whole family. Is your family Jesus-centered, or is it centered on something else? Think about some of the other things that families get centered on. For a lot of families, it's money. Like the number one thing is making money. I've known a lot of families for which this is true. Money is at the center of the family. Business, you know, entrepreneurship, or just like advancement at work, like the number one thing. Maybe this isn't what you would say, but if you're really honest about it, money is at the center of your family. Or how about education? For some families, education is central. Now, again, I'm not saying, by the way, that money is bad, not at all. I'm not saying education is bad, not at all. But when it takes center stage, it becomes a problem. Or how about travel? I know some families where like the whole point for their family is travel, trips, seeing the world, or getting away. There are families that every weekend they're going away somewhere, up to the mountains on a camping trip, or out to the lake to boat, or somewhere around the world. Like the center point of their family growing up, and it's probably because this is what they grew up with in their families, and they have fond memories of travel and vacations and all that kind of stuff. And again, that's not bad. Travel's not bad. Vacations aren't bad. But it becomes a problem if it's central, if it is what you are focused on. It's what your family is centered on. Or how about this next one? And this is huge these days. I think more than ever, sports. Some families are centered on sports. It is all about sports, whether playing sports, comp sports and things like that, or watching sports, you know, professional teams, college teams, whatever. I feel like sports and athletics, it has become an idol in our culture like never before. It's crazy to me. And some families are centered on sports. I've just got two more for my list for now. Some families are, like in general terms, you're just centered on success. Like whether maybe that's money or education or sports or whatever, but like the overall thing is success is the center. You better be successful. This is what you should be all about. And it's all about driving hard and making sure your kids are successful and you know, you're setting goals and you're reaching those goals. Again, I don't want you to misunderstand what I'm saying. I'm not saying that these things are bad. Money, education, travel, sports, success. These aren't bad things. They're bad when they become central, when they become everything to your family. When they're the focus of your family, now you've got a problem. Now you've got the recipe for dysfunction in your family. And I've got one more thing for my list that as I thought about this, some families are centered on, wait for it, family. And you say, wait, what do you mean by that? Well, actually, family can become an idol in and of itself. When your family is so centered on family, you're centered on your traditions, you're centered on your family relationships. And again, family is good. It's not a bad thing. But when family becomes the center of your family, now you've got a problem. Healthy families, truly healthy families, are Jesus-centered. The person at the center of the family is Jesus. It's not your family. It's not success. It's not sports. It's not travel. It's not education. It's not money. It's none of these things. At the center of your family is Jesus himself. Like you are a Jesus-centered family. That is a good thing. Here's what that might look like. Some of you are like, wait, what does it look like for my family to be Jesus-centered? I wouldn't even know what that looks like. I've never seen that before. Well, let me give you some examples because our family, Tracy and I, with our two kids, we really truly tried to be a Jesus-centered family. Now, we weren't perfect at it, but we really wanted to make sure Jesus was at the center. Here's what that looked like in a few areas. Number one, with time. It means that we made a real commitment to church community, for starters. Like, we weren't so centered on, let's say, travel or vacation or whatever. We weren't so centered on that that we sacrificed our Sundays in order to go, you know, we live in Utah, so we could have been skiing in the winter every single, you know, every time it was a good snow day, we could have just ditched out on church and gone skiing. In the summertime, we have beautiful mountains. It's just beautiful for, you know, being out on the lake or camping and things like that. I know families that do this, like they're just gone on the weekend because they're so centered on family time and vacation and travel and outdoors, all these wonderful, beautiful things that even though they might say that they love Jesus and they're Jesus-centered, they didn't actually leave any time for that. Their kids didn't grow up like connected to church community because they were never around. They were so busy doing all of the other stuff. So Jesus-centered for us meant that we really had time for getting connected into the local church. Or how about with our finances? Being Jesus-centered meant that we sacrificed to be a giver in the local church community, and we made sure that our kids knew it. Now, again, if you're centered on education or travel or sports or even your family, if you're centered on something else, then that's where all your money's going to go. Your money's going to go to your boats. Your money's going to go to your RVs. You know, your money's going to go to travel and vacations. Your money's going to go to comp sports because that's expensive stuff. Like that's, your money's going to go to education. But for us, again, it didn't mean that we didn't spend money on these other things, but they weren't central. Jesus was central. So we sacrificed, and our kids knew it. We wanted our kids to know that Jesus is at the center of our lives, of our marriage, of our family, and they saw it modeled. And so we were big givers. So that's time. That's finances. Well, let me just share one more example of what it looked like to be Jesus-centered as a family. And I'm just going to call this like the atmosphere in our home. We tried to create a Jesus-centered atmosphere in the home. Let me give you some examples of what that looked like. We modeled spiritual disciplines in the home. We really tried to model like reading the Bible in our own lives, prayer time, you know, these kinds of things. We modeled that in our home. We tried to model being Jesus-centered in our daily conversations. You know, if we're watching the news, if we're talking about politics or entertainment or some sports figure that just got in trouble because, you know, he's sleeping around or whatever, like we in our regular daily conversations, we tried to talk about that. Like, is that like, why is that wrong? Why would that be wrong? We try to talk about living our lives to honor God and how maybe some of the people that some of their friends weren't doing that, or some of our family, extended family members weren't doing that. Like, we weren't afraid. We didn't shy away from Jesus-centered conversations, bringing like God-honoring Bible verses into our daily lives with our kids. Like, that was just a normal part of the atmosphere of our home. And here's one more example with worship, like the music in our home. We're a musical family. We all love music. Like, we were intentional and still are about like having worship music playing in the mornings, in the evenings. You know, we want in the car when we're driving places in the car, we probably 90% of the time we're listening to worship music. Our kids are hearing worship music, not just on Sunday morning at church when we're singing worship songs together, but we wanted like God-honoring, Jesus-exalting music to like get into our kids' souls and ours as well. And so that was part of the atmosphere in our home and in our vehicles. Now think about it in your life. Is this what your family is like? Did I just pull back the curtain on our family? And are you saying right now, oh my gosh, that is not our family. We are not Jesus-centered. If that's true, I don't want you to feel guilty about it. I don't want you to feel a sense of shame about it. I just challenge you to make a commitment. We're gonna do this differently. We're going to have a Jesus-centered home. We're going to work on this. Here's what Moses said to the people of Israel way back in Deuteronomy 6 before they took over the promised land. It's called the Shema. This was kind of like the Pledge of Allegiance for every Israelite family. He said this, "Listen, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord alone is God, and you must love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your strength." He's talking about putting God at the center of the family and of the community. And look at what he says about it. He's really talking to parents and grandparents here. "And you must commit yourselves wholeheartedly to these commands I'm giving you today. Repeat them again and again to your children." See that? He's talking to parents and grandparents. "Talk about them when you're at home and when you're on the road, when you're going to bed and when you're getting up. Tie them to your hands and wear them on your foreheads as reminders. Write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates." What is Moses talking about here in the Shema in Deuteronomy 6? He's talking about being God-centered. Now, today we would say Jesus-centered. He's talking about a Jesus-centered home. I think it's super interesting that Moses, before the Israelites are about to establish homes and vineyards and government and community in the promised land that God is about ready to give the Israelites, right before this, like one of his final pep talks to the people is he's talking to parents and grandparents, and he's talking about families. He's talking about how to be God-centered as a family. Friends, moms, dads, if you want to live in the promised land that God has prepared for you, like if you want a healthy family, if you want a home that is truly blessed, the first trait of those kinds of homes is that they are Jesus-centered. If your family has been centered on something else, repent. Go to your knees before God. Even do that with your kids. Say, kids, I think we've been centered on money or education or travel or sports or success or even on family. I think we haven't kept our eye on the ball. I think we haven't been Jesus-centered. And from this day forward, we're going to be Jesus-centered. Let's make a commitment as a family to be Jesus-centered. That's the first trait. Trait number two of a healthy family is this: husbands and wives who choose love. This is actually principle number one in our Marriage Basics series online. If you want to check that one out, you can do that. We talk about the fact that a healthy family has a mom and a dad, a husband and a wife, who choose love. Because the most important relationship in the home, hear this, is between mom and dad. It's not between parents and kids. The most important relationship in the home, besides your relationship with God, is the relationship between mom and dad. Kids are going to pick up on this. When kids recognize that mom and dad have a relationship, not just mom and dad with the kids have a relationship, then I think there's a sense of security in the home. Mom and dad, you're modeling something that your kids are going to long for in their own future marriage. And this is really important. Now, I grew up in a home where I didn't see this so much. My parents are wonderful. I love my mom and my dad, but I didn't see so much their relationship together. I saw more their relationship with their kids. They really, you know, five kids, they really worked hard at teaming up to be good parents to our kids. I didn't really get to see mom and dad in relationship with each other so much. And so in my marriage, I wasn't thinking so much in terms of that. I was thinking, again, what I saw growing up, what I knew. I was thinking more about Tracy and myself, like working hard and playing our roles. And when kids were brought into the equation, and they were soon enough in our marriage, that we were going to be really good functional parents to our kids. But one of the things that we decided to do early on is that when I would come home from work, like my dad, when he came home from work, when I came home from work, we weren't going to just be focused on our kids. We were going to show our kids, we were going to model for our kids that we had a relationship, that we had a relationship before they came into the world, and that we were going to have a relationship after they left the home. And so the way we did this was with couch time. I would come home from a long day at work, and Tracy would be, we had a pretty traditional family growing up when our kids were little. Tracy would be making dinner for the family. And we made an agreement, Tracy and I did, that when I first came home, that I would be playing with the kids. I would spend some time with the kids while Tracy finished up dinner. Then we would have dinner as a family. And then after dinner, we said to the kids, AJ, Kenzie, it's mom and dad time. It's couch time for mom and dad. You guys do your thing, but mom and dad are going to sit on the couch and we're going to connect and we're going to talk about our days and we're going to build our relationship. And you know what's interesting is we told the kids, you can go to your rooms and play, do what you want, but the kids rarely did that. They would stay in the family room with us. Now, we wouldn't let them interrupt us because it wasn't their time. It was our time. But I think the reason that they did that is because they loved it. They loved that mom and dad, you know, they were playing with Legos or reading a book or whatever. AJ would play with his Matchbox cars, but they wanted to do it in the room. And there was something comforting for our kids about mom and dad investing in each other. They wanted to see mom and dad loving each other, working on a relationship. They probably couldn't articulate it like that, but there was something secure about that. There was something really healthy about that, that our kids saw a mom and dad who weren't perfect, but who chose to love each other in the ups and downs of everyday life. Now, today, when you watch movies, that's not what love is about. That's not what romantic love is about. It's about feelings that come and go, and you fall in love and maybe you get married, but then you fall out of love and then you find someone else to marry and fall in love with. That's not the biblical perspective. The biblical concept of marital love is a covenant between a man and a woman. It's a decision that you make that you are going to be in this for the long haul. And the example, the analogy that we have for this in Scripture is Jesus Christ himself, how Jesus Christ loves his church. The Bible says that it's like Jesus is the groom and the church is the bride. Ephesians 5 says this, "For husbands, this means love your wives just as Christ loved the church. He gave up his life for her to make her holy and clean, washed by the cleansing of God's word." So the picture that we have of a healthy marriage in the Bible is the picture of a husband who is willing to love his wife like Christ loved the church. What does that mean? That means that he gives up his life for her. That means he takes a bullet for her. That is sacrificial love. This is what we need in the home. We need more husbands who are committed to their wives for the long haul. We need more wives who are committed to the husbands for the long haul, who are going to say, "We're in it to the end. We're in it," just like our vows say, "We're in it until death do us part." Because look, this is the picture of a healthy family. This is a family that then perpetuates healthy families. When kids are raised in a home where they know the D word isn't thrown around, divorce, mom and dad aren't always thrown around the divorce word. We always tell couples in crisis, we say, "Don't use the D word." Especially I like to say this to husbands, "Men, your wife isn't perfect. No, duh. You're not perfect either. Okay. You're not perfect. It's not going to be better if you try to find another wife. You made a commitment. You made a vow. You need to be in it for the long haul. Give up your life for your wife. Give up your dreams. Don't think about the grass is greener on the other side." Biblical marriages are ones in which a husband and a wife choose to be in a covenant relationship until death do them part. And when kids are raised in that kind of an environment, they see the picture of biblical love. Now, look, I want to just mention this. Some of you are listening to this and you've already blown it. Some of you are listening to this and that ideal picture is no longer an option for you. And I want to just encourage you. The point to this is not to shame you or to condemn you or to make you feel guilty because it didn't work out the way that I just described, this ideal picture. I want to just encourage you. God can still redeem. God can still use families that are less than ideal. So even though trait number two might not be the reality for you right now in your life, I want to just encourage you not to be discouraged. God can still bring beauty from ashes. He can still work miracles. He can still allow our kids to be healthy, even if they're not raised in a totally healthy environment in the home. So trait number one, families who are Jesus-centered. Trait number two, husbands and wives who choose love. And trait number three, the third trait and the final trait for today's episode of a healthy family are moms and dads who transfer ownership. Now, maybe you didn't expect this, but let me just explain what I mean by this. The fundamental law of parenting, we talk about this a lot on our family podcast, is that healthy parents transfer ownership of the kids' life and choices over the course of 18 years from parent to child. Let me say that again. That was kind of a mouthful. Healthy parents transfer ownership of the kids' life and choices over the course of 18 years from parent to child. Now, before I explain what this means, let me explain the extreme opposite of healthy parenting. There's two extremes. On one end are controlling parents who never let their kids make choices, ever. From infancy to high school years and beyond, like they're just micromanaging their kids' lives. And those are controlling, authoritarian parents. And that is not healthy. Healthy parents transfer ownership over time. They let their kids make choices over time. So on the one end of the spectrum are controlling parents. on the far other end of the spectrum are uninvolved parents. These are parents who don't care about their kids' choices. They basically let their kids make choices as early as possible. Like, they don't give any direction. They don't give any guidance. They don't give any instruction to their kids. That is really unhealthy as well. So what's the sweet spot? The sweet spot is the healthy parent who knows how to transfer ownership appropriately over the years from 0 to 18. So in the infant stage, parents, obviously, you're going to be like 90% owners, maybe even more, of your kids' lives. Like, you're going to be doing just about everything for your infant, for your toddler. Now, you can't breathe for them. You can't eat for them. You can't poop for them. But those are about the only things that they do for themselves. Just about everything else you're doing for your infant, you have to take a lot of ownership of their lives. Obviously, abusive parents are ones that neglect their children as infants. That's really sad. We all know that that's wrong. Okay. But when they get into elementary age, parents, you need to start, like, obviously giving over some ownership. Let's say that maybe parents are like 70-30 owners at this point in the elementary age. Well, by the time you get to, let's say, junior high, maybe it's starting to switch. And now, parents, you're maybe a 40-60 owner. You're starting to give your kids more and more ownership of their own lives in the junior high years, so that by the time they get to high school, and certainly by late high school, the student better be the 90% owner of their life. If they're not, parents, if you haven't brought them to the point where they can really own most of their life, then you're in for a big surprise by the time they're hitting those college age years or they go out and start a career. So transferring ownership by the high school years means that they own their academics, they manage their homework, their study habits, their grades. You let them manage more of their time, like balancing work and friends and responsibilities. You're hopefully teaching them some financial management through part-time jobs and budgeting or bank accounts. Maybe you're involving them in family decision-making and major life discussions, you know, as you're fostering this maturity in their thinking, in their lives. So what you're doing overall is you're shifting. This is a good way to think about it. You're shifting from discipline to dialogue. You know, in those early years, you had to discipline more. Hopefully, by the time they're getting to their late high school years, you're shifting into more dialogue. You're moving from enforcing consequences to coaching decision-making. And we see this in a really well-known proverb. If you don't know this proverb, I encourage you to memorize this. Proverb 22, verse 6. The ESV says it like this: "Train up a child in the way he should go, and even when he is old, he will not depart from it." And I want you to highlight or underline in your Bibles one word: should. It says, train up a child in the way he should go. So what this means is, parents, I want you to hear this. There is a should to parenting. For Christian parenting, for healthy parenting, we raise our kids to understand right and wrong. We raise them not just to understand study habits and friendship and budgeting and all these things I just mentioned, but we're raising them to understand values. You're transferring ownership, not just of their choices and responsibilities. You're actually, hopefully, transferring ownership of your values to your kids. Because look, you know, trait number one is we're Jesus-centered. So hopefully your goal as a Christian parent is to raise your kid to own your biblical values, to raise your kids to be Jesus-centered, so that when they leave the home, they didn't just see mom and dad being Jesus-centered. They didn't see mom and dad choosing love, which is a biblical value. But now, by the time they leave your home, and it's not like your parenting is totally done, you're going to still parent them a little bit even as they move into the adult years. But still, hopefully they've owned your values. They've been raised in a home that's healthy, where they're like, I want to live like mom and dad live. Like, I want to follow Jesus. like mom and dad followed Jesus. Someday when I get married, I want a marriage where we choose love, where we're committed to each other, where we have a covenant with one another till death do us part. This is healthy parenting. Healthy parenting transfers ownership of our values from parents to kids. And this, to me, is the greatest sign of a healthy family, not a perfect family. Because we don't want our kids to leave the home thinking that they have to be perfect, because none of us will be perfect, right? Adam and Eve, their family wasn't perfect. Isaac and Rebecca's family, David and Bathsheba's family, Zebedee's family, James and John, none of these families were perfect. And no family from the beginning till now will ever be perfect. But our families can be healthy, and that's different. So what about you? Did this just give you a glimpse of a family that does things differently than yours? I encourage you actually to talk about this with your spouse, even talk about this with your kids if it's appropriate, and say, how can we grow in this area? What can we borrow? What traits can we begin to borrow now from a truly healthy family? And let's make a commitment to bring that into our household, and let's see what God can do through us.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to share this episode with a friend. Find more resources to talk about these topics with your small group, family, or mentor on pursuegod.org.